Thank you, everyone, for coming. We may have a few stragglers in, but we're just going to get started so we have time for discussion. So I know many of you, some of you I don't know. I'm Jennifer Redmond. I'm in the History Department, and I teach 19th and 20th century history for the main part, focusing on Ireland. So I have been working with Una Frawley, who is in the English Department, who sends her apologies that she can't be here, on developing a series of talks and roundtables, and Una's also focusing on artistic kind of representations, all commemorating the events of the revolutionary period. And one of the things that Una in particular was vexed by was that the series of events that had been launched nationally in particular were excluding women, either historically or contemporaneously. So they were excluding their voices as they had contributed in the past, and they also weren't including women historians to give their views on this revolutionary period. So that's the impetus behind a lot of the events that have happened so far and will happen throughout the year. Now, I was very lucky in that Diane Urquhart, who's from the University of Liverpool, was coming to address our research seminar in the department yesterday, and she kindly agreed to do this piece today on Unionist women. Diane has written really the standard bearer that all historians really have to look to for the experience of Unionist women in this period. Her work has been critically acclaimed. It's wonderful to read, it's accessible, and it's very important because I think through our schooling and through our kind of just general approach to this history, there's a lot of focus on nationalist women, and even at the fringe end of that, the most radical. But Unionist women, who were extremely active, very well organised, very networked with their male parliamentary peers, they are often left out of the story. And in fact, if we look even in terms of militaristic terms, and I know Diane's going to talk about this, they were actually extremely active. They were drilling. They were very interested in physically fighting if the chance arose. So it seems strange to leave them out of the equation. So Diane is going to talk to us today based on, as I said, her groundbreaking and standard-bearing work on Unionist women. She has many, many publications in this area, and I think that we should all feel very lucky that she's here today. She's from the Institute of Irish Studies in Liverpool, and she's asked me to, I'm going to pass around a flyer for the Conference of Irish Historians in Britain. She's one of the organisers. It's happening in July in Liverpool, and lucky for you, there are student rates and bursaries available if you want to go. I know some of you are in third year and you may be reading Theodore Hoppin's book, and he will be there, as will Roy Foster, another one that you're reading. So it's a great chance to see some of the minds that you've been reading in historiography of Irish history in person. So I'll be handing out a flyer, but will you please help me welcome Diane now?
Good morning, everyone. And thank you, Jen, for those very kind words. I think I'm blushing slightly. I hope I live up to the billing. What I'm going to talk about this morning is the unity of unionism. So thinking about women's place in the unionist movement, I'm going to start off with a historical overview and then think about the covenant and the women's version of that, the Women's Declaration of 1912. Use that as a little bit of a case study, and then think about the centenary commemorations of the covenant in particular, because it gives us an interesting time for reflection. The establishment of the Ulster Women's Unionist Council early in 1911 was significant. Significant in the history of unionism and significant in the history of Irish women's political activism. This organisation developed into an active and very sizeable body that sought to bind the unionist women together in a common aim with unionist men. That aim was the resistance of Irish Home Rule. Unionism peaks in popularity in the early 20th century, a period which also sees the growth of a defiant, introspective process of Ulsterisation. So by the time the Ulster Women's Unionist Council is created, we're dealing less with a phenomenon of Irish unionism and more with Ulster unionism, and that is an important process. That process was epitomised perhaps best by Ulster Day in September 1912, the day when both the Solemn League and Covenant was signed and the Women's Declaration. But that event and its recent centenary raised questions regarding the past, but also the current so-called unity of unionism. Let's look to the past first of all. Unionist women were involved in the anti-Home Rule campaigns from the time, of course, of Gladstone's first Home Rule Bill in 1886. That bill proposed to establish an Irish Parliament with restricted powers and, although quickly defeated, sparked an unprecedented coming together of unionists. Opposition to that bill quickly overcame, at least superficially, former denominational, class and to some extent gender divide. So this interesting coming together of unionism in 1886. Unionist women, although unable to express their political distaste for Home Rule by the means of a parliamentary vote, instead were petitioning, demonstrating, fundraising, canvassing for unionist candidates. This bill also spawned the first organisation of unionist women, with Ireland's foremost feminist reformer behind me, Isabella Todd, largely abandoning all of her other manifold interests for unionism and what she referred to, and I quote, her sickening shock at the prospect of Home Rule. Todd established a branch of the London-based Women's Liberal Unionist Association in Belfast in 1886. And by that stage in her career, she has a fairly formidable reputation as a writer and also as a fine orator. And that opens doors for her which weren't available to other unionist women. Todd goes on a speaking tour of England with a male delegation from the Ulster Liberal Unionist Association, but she is the sole female representative. And for most women, resisting Home Rule at this juncture meant conducting auxiliary work. And in many respects, that sets the tone for women's subsequent involvement in the anti-Home Rule campaigns and arguably continues to this day. In spite of that auxiliary status, these early forays of women into unionist politics were important. They were introducing women to politicking, many for the first time. Unionists galvanised into action again when the second Home Rule Bill was passing through the Commons in the 1890s. Holding mass demonstrations such as the Belfast Convention in 1892. But the cooperation which Todd had earlier experienced was now seemingly waning as unionism took on a more public facade. Women were not permitted to attend that convention, and the rationale for that was, and I quote, to dampen any suggestion of frivolity. So this raises the question of where women are being placed within the unionist movement and arguably politics more broadly. Todd instead organised a committee to hold a meeting in Belfast on the day preceding the convention. So here's her negotiation. She refers to this as a social gathering, as a conversazione, but this was window dressing. This was a mixed-sex assembly attended by several hundred, and Todd's address was distinctly political. She referred to Home Rule as, and I quote, the furnace of revolution, and cautioned that, and again I quote, Ulster raises its voice of solemn warning. And again, an early interesting comment on the alignment of unionism with Ulster rather than as Ireland more broadly. Unionist women were also petitioning in increasing number. One of the largest petitions at this point contained close to 20,000 signatures and was conveyed to Parliament in a carriage in 1893 belonging to this woman, Teresa, 6th Marchioness of Londonderry, I think the most influential president of the Ulster Women's Unionist Council, and we'll say a little bit more about her as we move through this morning's talk. This increasingly public profile of unionist women fits into a broader context of women in British politics. The 1880s and 1890s see the formation of a proliferation of mixed sex, but more commonly female-only political associations. Here we can look to the Conservatives' Primrose League, for example, the Women's Liberal Federation, founded in 1883 and 1886, respectively. The Women's Labour League followed a little later in 1906. The reasons for the establishment of these bodies was less feminist than pragmatic. The Corrupt and Illegal Practices Act of 1883 forbade the payment of political canvassers, and that legislation, coupled with the extension of a male electoral franchise in the following year, encouraged party organisers to look for a source of unpaid and volunteer political labour. They turned to women. So that opens the doors, and we can see it really in all of the areas that you might want to look at. small local union associations were active in various parts of Ulster in the early 20th century. Here we can look to North Tyrone, for example, a female body there from 1907. Derry from 1909 had a similar body. But the inauguration of the Ulster Women's Unionist Council in January 1911 established a centralised and a permanent association. This body, as I said at the outset, became hugely popular within a relatively short period of time. This was part of a process which Alvin Jackson has rightly described as unionism becoming popular for the first time in its history. By the end of 1911, 32 branches of the Ulster Women's Unionist Council were formed throughout Ulster, with a collective membership of between 40 and 50,000. 2 years later, the press was quoting membership figures in the region of 115 to 200,000. And although a margin of exaggeration is of course to be expected there, the sheer scale of this organisation's activities, attendances at their public demonstrations, like this one behind me, held in Belfast with an overflow meeting having to be held, as well as signatories to petitions, all support the fact that this was a very sizeable organisation. Much of the explanation for this popularity lies in the fact that the years of 1911 to 1914 were crisis points in the history of unionism. The Parliament Act of 1911 is absolutely key to understanding this. That, as I'm sure some of you are aware, removed the last constitutional bulwark against Home Rule. It limited the power of Lords to a two-year veto, which meant that any bill could no longer be defeated outright, but only delayed for 2 years. For unionists, this gained a grim reality when the Government of Ireland Bill of 1912 was defeated by the Lords, but that wasn't an absolute defeat. Rather, it was delayed for just 2 years. So I think that is part of the explanation about why we see this mobilisation, this formalisation, and this lure of unionism. In addition to that, the fact that this organisation was led by members of Ulster's aristocratic elite, such as the organisation's early presidents, which included two Duchesses of Abercorns, the aforementioned Teresa, Marchioness of Londonderry, gave this organisation respectability and likely attracted many members. Those who work in more detail on the Primrose League, the Conservative organisation, make that point very forcibly as well, that this was hugely beneficial to these organisations. As was common to many political women in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the leaders of women's unionism were connected to the movement by familial and marital ties. And again, unionism not unusual in seeing this familial connection. Just to give you one quick example of that, spouse of the Ulster Women's Unionist Council's first president, Mary Ann, second Duchess of Abercorn. He was a unionist MP for Donegal from 1860. He was the leading spokesman for unionism in the Lords from the middle of the 1890s. He was also first president of the Unionist Association of Ireland. So he's heading up male unionism. She's doing exactly the same for the emerging female movement. Just going to go back briefly to Teresa, 6th Marchioness of Londonderry. This was the council's second and I think most influential president. She was very politically astute, very well connected, has left a wonderful collection of correspondence behind her, and a lot of that is down in the Public Record Office of Northern Ireland in Belfast and on open access and well worth a look. This was the so-called Queen of Toryism. She was one of the leading political hostesses in the early 20th century, and she promoted both her husband's and her son's careers by entertaining royalty and the socio-political elite. And her career is a really interesting reminder of how politics worked at this time. High politics had this very aristocratic and social edge to it. Described by one contemporary, and it's my favourite quote about her, as a woman who, and here's the quote, went for life, hammer and tongs, she collared it, she scragged it and rooked it like a highway woman in a tiara. She is feared and admired in equal measure. She was also an early and very influential patron of the unionist leader, Edward Carson. He regarded her as his best friend and really confides in her and asks for her advice repeatedly through this very difficult political process. She was also very close to the Tory leader, Andrew Bonar Law, but that was more of a manufactured friendship because she knew she needed to get him on side. There was perhaps initially less affinity between the two, but he was widowed and came to rely on her actually very heavily for those more social political entertainments which he was required to give. And connections like these allowed a local organisation like the Ulster Women's Unions Council to act on a much wider stage. Many of the most active members of this organisation were upper class, as we've heard, but also middle class in social composition. And throughout women in Britain, it's women from these classes who possessed the time and economic freedom to participate in political life. This organisation's ruling body, its executive committee, not only met on weekdays, but also during normal working hours, which obviously precluded much working women's involvement. But those upper and middle class women should not overshadow the importance of many women who were working at a local level amongst the various unions associations that were established throughout Ulster. And here we do see more lower middle class and working class women active. And for many, this was their first experience of politicking. The role which this organisation defined for itself was always distinct from that of men. I think this is something that shapes them right from the outset. They sought to work by means of gentleness, tact and quiet influence. And you can see First President of the organisation making that comment behind me. Like its forerunners, this was and remained an auxiliary body formed to complement rather than rival the work of male unionists. This body also identified home rule as their sole concern, and they had leaflets to hand out at meetings to make that very clear. Most strikingly, this meant that the question of women's suffrage, of course, happening at exactly the same time as the home rule campaigns, would not be discussed. So they won't talk about it. A range of anti-home rule arguments was aired as unionist men and women alike objected to home rule on religious, economic, imperial and constitutional grounds. But the Ulster Women's Unionist Council also develops an influential gendered argument where the sanctity of the home featured strongly. And here, as hopefully you can see if my head's not in the way, the home was talked about a lot. Politics was seen as an extension of maternal and protective instincts. They're trying to put this female appeal out there. Members of this organisation were also sometimes referred to as the motherhood of Ulster. This was also a way to make unionism appear relevant to women's lives, so to make them feel that they had a place in this movement and attract members. And Colm McCarthy's more recent work on Cumann na mBan, for example, says that they follow this example. So you can pick up that domestic rhetoric coming through their work. But they're, if McCarthy's right, and I think he probably is, they're looking at the success of this organisation and trying to echo it, but on the totally opposite side of the political spectrum. The activities of the Women's Council bore many similarities to the type of work which women had conducted during those earlier home rule crises. So disseminating propaganda, for example, was key. By September 1913, they were sending 10,000 leaflets and newspapers per week to Britain. They were also having big campaigns into America and some of the Dominions as well. This is part of their maxim that prevention is better than cure. So a huge propaganda campaign. Mass meetings, again, highlight the level of enthusiasm that unionism could arise at this time. Just to give you again a couple of examples, an estimated 10,000 women attended an Ulster Women's Unionist Council meeting in Belfast in late 1912, and more than twice that, perhaps as many as 25,000 women, greeted Carson on his first visit to West Belfast in the following year in 1913. That was believed to be the largest assemblage of women in Ireland's history. Members of this organisation also worked as so-called unionist missionaries in Britain, and here they would cooperate with pro-union bodies like the Conservatives Primrose League, the Women's Protestant Union, and most commonly the Women's Amalgamated Unionist and Tariff Reform Association, not the punchiest title for an organisation, often abbreviated to WAUTRA, WATRA. And there they would be updating electoral registers, they would address meetings, they would also canvass. Between April and May of 1914, 56 members of the council left their homes to conduct this type of work in Britain. The time that they were spending in Britain varied from as little as 4 days, sometimes as much as 5 weeks. And we know that at least 26 women were based permanently in England and Scotland at the height of the third Home Rule crisis. So again, think about the impact of politics and taking some women, largely single women, understandably so, out of that domestic containment of their lives and, you know, travelling sometimes unchaperoned, but often travelling in pairs, understandably, to do this type of political work. The unionist leadership was ever conscious of the significance of maintaining unity in order to present a favourable public image to the English electorate, where they initially thought that Home Rule could be defeated. They therefore made consistent attempts to present unionists as a respectable community with valid reasons for resisting Home Rule. And the scheme for Ulster Day, the day declared on the 20th September 1912, is one of the most striking examples of that, with unionist men and women signing the Solemn League and Covenant and the Women's Declaration, respectively. And this is an interesting one. This is signed, I don't know if you can see this, this is Maud Gallagher signing in the City Hall in Belfast. So she's signing the text of the Women's Declaration. I'll show you that in a different slide because I know that's going to be difficult to read. But this is a souvenir copy, and Ulster Solemn League and Covenant is the heading. This is actually the Women's Declaration signed by a woman. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, and it's an unusual one. It's the only one I've seen. And as I say, I think it's really just a souvenir copy produced after the event, but interesting for us nonetheless. And here is the text of the Women's Declaration. In many ways, the Covenant and the Declaration of 1912 avert the way which women were arguably marginalised within the unionist movement. Women were not permitted to sign the Covenant by the all-male policy-making body of unionism, the Ulster Unionist Council. Rather, they had to negotiate to draw up this separate document, which you can see behind me. The shorter text of the Women's Declaration, like the Covenant, was drafted by Thomas Sinclair. And although the Ulster Women's Unionist Council's advisory committee could comment on the draft of the Women's Declaration, it's actually not clear if they did so. The final text was also subject to the approval of the Ulster Unionist Council, so they're not allowed to sign the Covenant, but nor do they get a free hand in designing this document to be signed. Theresa Londonderry's Ulster Day speech also had to be sanctioned by James Craig, who commented with considerable relief that, and I quote, it struck the right note, and he added, of course, none of us would have ventured to alter a word without submitting it again for her approval. So Craig, not delighted to get that job, but happy to say it's fine. The text of the Declaration has words like calamity in common with the male covenant. But it clearly enshrines women's place within unionism. They would, and I hope you can see this behind me, associate themselves, the term that they use, with men as part of the unionist movement. Women also had to make separate arrangements to set up signing stations for this document throughout Ulster. But there was undoubtedly more collegiality at a local level than that might suggest. Again, I always think we have to scratch the surface a little. Many of the agents responsible for collecting the signed declaration forms were, for example, men who were also collating the covenant. And this little example, this is Rafoe in Donegal on so-called Ulster Day. Here's women signing the declaration on a table. I hope you can just about make this out, signing the covenant. So again, locally, I think people just pooled together to have these documents signed. Signatures were collected at various destinations, and here are women signing in Belfast, reprinted from the London Illustrated News. But they also set up signing stations at various town halls, temperance missions, Orange Hall, schools, churches. Some signed in their own homes. And there were door-to-door collections, as this photograph illustrates. There were also outdoor venues. Church grounds was a very common signing place. The illiterate, as you can see from this example, here, signed just with an X, and then the collection agents would fill in their names. That's an example from East Belfast, Westbourne Presbyterian Church in the east of the city. Signatories to these documents provide one of the best examples of the scale of unionist opposition to Home Rule, but also the comparative strength of women's unionism. Just to put some figures onto that, a total of over 228,000 women signed the declaration in Ulster, compared to 218,000 men, or just over. So more women signed this document in Ulster than did men. And it's a considerable roundabout, you're doing sums in your head, more than 16,000. Collectively, these figures mean that round about three quarters of Ulster's non-Catholic adults over the age of 16 signed these documents. So it is a huge display. And it's interesting, it's a point we often forget, but the Covenant and Declaration weren't presented to anyone. This was all posturing, this is display, this is like, look at how sizable we are. But this didn't go to Parliament, this wasn't presented to anyone. And again, you can access it online, a great resource through the Public Record of Northern Ireland website. Some people have done that and been horrified to find relatives who they didn't think would have signed actually did. So it's worthwhile having a look, and you can search it by name. You can also do interesting county breakdowns, and say a really good electronic resource. There was also a British covenant which was signed for those of Ulster birth. That was signed in England and Scotland, and that attracted more male signatories than female. I'll move my head out of the way so people on this side of the room can see. So just over 19,000 men signing that British covenant, smaller numbers of women. And when we combine the two, we see that 237,000 men just over signed the Covenant overall when we combine the British and the Ulster one, and 234,000 female signatories. So this display of female strength in Ulster, really significant. This lower figure that we see for women in Britain is probably a comment on just the lower number of women's political associations in Britain which were pro-union and could organise this. Unionist plans for provisional government came in the following September. So September 1913, here are unionism starting to look a little bit more defiant, moving away from reliance on Westminster. But constitutional means to defeat Home Rule were looking increasingly inadequate. The formation of the Ulster Volunteer Force in early 1913 signalled a formal move to militarism within unionism. As Jen mentioned in the introduction, the Ulster Women's Unionist Council was involved in the activities of the Ulster Volunteer Force. They were administering nursing, driving and signalling corps, drafting training schemes, organising first aid classes, sometimes drilling, securing medical equipment and supplies for UVF medical units which were established throughout Ulster. This is a preparation for civil war. This also started to involve women in perhaps less characteristic activities, so moves them away from that sort of nursing base. Some become involved in intelligence work, deciphering police messages, for example. A small number of women were involved in gun running, with one woman allegedly defying troops in Belfast to search her whilst pregnant. She actually had rounds of ammunition strapped around her waist. But we don't have too many examples of that. But we think there's enough evidence to say that this happened perhaps on occasion. And again, this has got a long tail, this notion that women would be find it much easier to evade arrest is something that we can, you know, stretch right back into the 19th century and beyond. There were, however, very few warmongers within this organisation. Rather, what we're seeing at this point is a resolution to support whatever course of action was needed to defeat Home Rule. Many people were very reluctant to go this route, but they saw options were just diminishing, and of course the spectre of the Home Rule Bill being passed in 1914 was ever present. But the outbreak of the First World War, of course, changed everything. But this was also another very stark reminder of women's place within unionism. They were not consulted on the unionist political truce which was declared on the outbreak of war. So again, that's a decision taken by the all-male Ulster Unionist Council, and I can find no evidence of any consultation with this very sizeable female body. During the war, the focus of this organisation shifted, changed to recruiting, supporting military conscription, dispatching comforts, making military dressings at Unionist headquarters in Belfast, also fundraising for the armed forces and their families. And support was particularly marked for the 36th Ulster Division, that embodiment of the UVF. Most seem to have accepted this change in priorities. But the question of Home Rule and the uncertainty of their post-war political situation was never wholly forgotten. This organisation, for example, sought to instruct soldiers in the Home Rule issue, so as the war waged in Europe, they were still sending out little pieces of anti-Home Rule propaganda. This work was only sanctioned by the Ulster Unionist Council on the basis that it was conducted on an individual basis, because they were trying to maintain that political truce. Many who've looked at the truce in more detail suggest that it was a bit of a facade and there was a lot going on behind the scenes. So again, this is just perhaps one example of that. But there is a duality there. So all this war work, but this quiet political campaign rumbled on. That duality was again apparent early in 1916 in the aftermath of the Rising, when it was feared that the continued political truce would be counterproductive to unionism. So people start to get scared and they didn't want to give any advantage to a Republican advance. So again, there's a lot of correspondence between the unionist leaders about what should they do. Should they abandon the truce? Should they start politicking again? But they're told really just to sit still, work quietly, work as individuals, but not to remobilise this movement while the war continued. The Representation of the People Act in 1918, giving the electoral franchise to women over the age of 30, again, while the war was ongoing, caused a similar reassessment. The truce remained formally in place, but the Ulster Women's Unionist Council registered voters, electioneered, and was instructing this new female electorate on how to cast a vote. So again, that work becomes more public, but they didn't think they had an option. They also supported women standing for local government election, but not for parliamentary election. And that's not specific to that first 1918 election when women could vote, but runs for a very long time. The view of this organisation was, and I quote, that men candidates were preferable. That stand can partially be explained by this organisation's innate conservatism. It had never advocated votes for women, but neither the Unionist leadership or the Ulster Unionist Council encouraged female parliamentary candidates. Edward Carson clearly expressed this in 1921 when advising an Ulster Women's Unionist Council meeting that, and I quote, in choosing candidates to choose the man who they thought would best represent their views. Over a decade later, although the Ulster Women's Unionist Council expressed the belief that it would be helpful to the unionist cause if more women would come forward to local government and town council work, and they employed female political trainees in their headquarters, they funded scholarships to train women in politics, economics and citizenship, they did not openly promote female candidates for election to the Northern Ireland Parliament or to Westminster. So it's a very interesting positioning. However, to assess the significance of female enfranchisement solely in terms of the number of women who were elected to Parliament overlooks the fact that possessing a vote cast women in a new political light. No longer could any astute politician overlook them. And the impact of the 1918 Representation of the People Act was very quickly apparent. Unionist leaders gave the Women's Council permission to reorganise and continue as a separate organisation. The vote also seemed to bolster the confidence of this organisation. It issues an uncharacteristic vehement appeal, demanding a definition of status within the unionist movement and representation on that all-male Ulster Unionist Council. I won't read all of this out, but this is a very uncharacteristic appeal that they make. The Ulster Unionist Council, the all-male policy-making body, had given representation to the Apprentice Boys and Unionist Clubs, both male organisations, in 1911. That left the Women's Council as the only mass organisation outside of its ranks. And that was justified on the basis that you needed to be registered as a voter to sit on the Ulster Unionist Council. So post-1918, that rationale, of course, couldn't be upheld. That earlier position had caused some criticism. There are some women within this movement who are more radical and challenge it. And we can see that, especially from 1916 onwards. But this becomes much more forthright in 1918. So I'm not going to read all of this, but this midsection, when they ask, what is the position of the Ulster Women's Unionist Council? It has none, we are nothing. Is it right or just that we should be in this position, that we should remain in this position? Are we wise to reorganise and spend the large sum of money involved and trouble ourselves and expand our health and strength if we have no recognition? But it took the vote for them to make this stand. And that appeal, coupled with a bit of self-interest on the part of the unionist leaders, was a catalyst for change. This body was granted 12 representatives on the Ulster Unionist Council. That was just 3% of the 40% that the Ulster Women's Unionist Council felt would be fair. In reality, they would have been happy with maybe 10 to 12 representation, but they just get 3%. And looking at recent figures and breakdowns of the gender composition of the Ulster Unionist Council, it's still in existence today. 34 members are female representatives of this organisation out of a body of more than 850. So things perhaps move slowly. However, what we see is a joint committee of male and female unionists being established in 1918 to coordinate work between the two bodies. But again, there is no question over which is the dominant partner. The Ulster Women's Unionist Council was not consulted over the partition of Ireland and the six-county configuration of the new Northern Ireland. So again, excluded, not included in that. And that was a very difficult position because, again, this was an Ulster province-wide organisation. It had branches in Cavan and Monaghan and Donegal. It faces resignations and very severe criticism for abandoning those three border counties and with this six-figure configuration. So it's difficult. They weren't consulted. This body continued as is still in existence today. It is therefore a unique survivor of the proliferation of women's political associations that we see established in early 20th century Ireland. Political meetings and the dissemination of propaganda continue into the interwar period, and they produce newspapers. One of them was called Northern Ireland Home and Politics, produced in the early 1920s for a couple of years. And even that title, I think, gives us a hint of this continued combination of domesticity with more civic affairs. This was also apparent in the efforts of this body to politically educate women and girls, and they do work more with youth organisations in the interwar period than they had done previously. They often held classes that combined education with entertainment, and they defined women's interests as family, housing, education and social services, and therefore is distinct from those of men. So this remains with them for a very long time. This was, as I've said, an intrinsically auxiliary and a conservative organisation, but arguably an important one. The sheer size of this body and the scale of its activities are an effective illustration of the degree of political interest which many women had years before they possessed the right to vote. The body that we see emerging in the early 20th century remains the largest political force that Ireland has ever seen. Membership of the suffrage movement, for example, is estimated at peaking at around about 3,500. Cum na Mons membership peaked at perhaps 12,000 in 1919. So this is a huge organisation. This body also made a significant contribution to the strength of popular unionism, and its espousal of unionist principles, although having much in common with male unionists, was no mere imitation. The fact that many women remain members of this body not just over years but decades alludes to a deep sense of political responsibility and sometimes fear. They were not seen as the political equals of men, and nor did they want to be. I think we always need to think about what did women want to do. It's very easy to victimise them and be very critical of a male organisation, you know, sitting over a female body, but we have to think about what did this organisation seek to do. Their work gave women a place within unionism and took many women out of the domestic containment of their lives. I think that's particularly true of middle-class women who were such an important part of this movement. Despite its size and arguably its import, this body is not popularly known. It still receives minimal attention in histories of unionism. In 2006, the Irish Times reflected on the 90th anniversary of the 1916 Rising and noted that that commemoration tended, and I quote, to forget about one important group of participants, women. And the 1912 centenary of Ulster Day offered a similar opportunity for reflection. But it's very hard to distinguish a definite tradition of female unionist commemoration and where it's apparent, it often does not follow the same path as male unionists. 2012, that centenary year for the Covenant and Declaration, saw a reenactment of Carson signing the Covenant at Belfast City Hall. But the most popular focus for the centenary commemorations was a 6-mile march throughout Belfast to Parliament buildings in the east of the city. That happened on the 29th of September 2012, so that was the centenary of Ulster Day. Feeder parades converged to bring an estimated 30,000 people together in that march, but this was much more a display and an engagement with an Orange parading tradition than with unionism per se. And just a couple of examples of that. So any of you are familiar with Stormont and Parliament buildings in Belfast will know this is the mile-long hill that comes up. This is the Carson statue. And again, you can see Orange banners coming up. So it was a huge display, very much fitting that Orange parading tradition. And looking at it, there was some interesting press comment, some of which I think rightly remarked that this was a celebration, a unionist celebration certainly, but not one celebrated or commemorated by a wider pro-unionist base. It was seen again also as an almost exclusively Protestant commemoration, and again that Orange display I think reinforces that. The parade itself was organised by the Orange Order and by the Unionist Centenary Committee. That committee was chaired by Belfast Orange Grand Master, and it took the text of the Solemn League and Covenant as its mission statement. There was no engagement with the Women's Declaration at all. In 2011, that Unionist Centenary Committee had drawn up 6 events that it wanted to commemorate. And again, to me, a very revealing list. The first was a Balmoral Review held in Belfast in April of 1912, where Conservative leader Bonar Law had addressed the crowds and raised his hand with Carson to pledge, and I quote, "Never under any circumstances will we submit to Home Rule." So a defiant meeting with Carson and Bonar Law. So that was on the list, and that event certainly provided some of the inspiration for the Covenant and Declaration which followed just 5 months later. Also on that Centenary Committee's list was Ulster Day of September 1912. And again, sorry, there's just another photograph of parades up Stormont Hill. Third thing on the list was the establishment of the Ulster Volunteer Force in 1913. The fourth was the Ulster Volunteer Force gun running of April of the following year. The Ulster Division, the 36th Division's march in Belfast in May 1916 was fifth on the list, and finally the Battle of the Somme occurring just a few months after that in July 1916. So the 6 events that they specified as worthwhile commemorating. That marking of events was largely militaristic. It totally overlooked the establishment of the Ulster Women's Unionist Council in January 1911. That Centenary Committee had met since 2009 to plan for this. So it was not a case of having insufficient time to mark the centenary of the women's organisation. Rather, I think this fits art critic John Berger, who I'm a great fan of, his notions of ways of seeing. If you don't look, you won't see. And I think this was a very interesting and revealing list that was drawn up. The Centenary Committee itself noted that its consultation process saw, and I quote, "young people, female politicians and religious people involved, but not enough." So there was a level of self-reflection there. But what that process did was allow a male and an Orange dominance. And that very much characterised the event itself. This close Orange association with the Ulster Day commemorations was not, however, new. The 50th commemorations in 1962, for example, had also seen the Orange Order feature prominently. So I think it's interesting to look back. I know maybe quite a few of you are interested in 1916, and obviously this year is such a pivotal year for us. So look back would be my advice on that. What happened at those earlier commemorations? That commemoration also saw questions being asked on the advisability of holding such an event. So in 1962, people saying, has this got very divisive potential? The Omagh-based Ulster Herald newspaper, for example, suggested that, and I quote, after being interned for 50 years, the corpse of the Covenant was dragged from its unholy grave to help the Unionist people propagandise. It also questioned the role of such a commemoration, suggesting, and again I quote, Unionists are divided on whether it is a good thing to have a Covenant celebration at all, very pertinently wondering what is it to celebrate in a community where the grim spectre of mass unemployment stalks today as threatening as in 1912. They also suggested that widespread public ignorance, and that's their term, not mine, of what the Covenant was and what it achieved was revealed in a newspaper poll in Belfast. Most people knew nothing, they concluded, and almost all had no interest in the Covenant. And again, interesting to see that. So that's 1962. Many onlookers to the events as they were rolling out in 2012 likely shared some of those concerns. The parade that was planned was overshadowed by protests, by violence, arrests and riots, with close to 60 policemen being injured in the north of the city over subsequent nights. St Patrick's Catholic Church in Donegal Street, which is in the north of the city, and St Matthew's Catholic Church on the Newton Arch Road in East Belfast were sites of particularly marked violence. As a result, the Northern Ireland Parades Commission restricted the 190 orange bands on the Ulster Day Parade to play only sacred music when passing Catholic churches. But as one North Belfast resident Riley remarked, and I quote, nobody can work out what type of hymn was being played outside St Patrick's as the bandsmen danced by. And they continued, the minute they passed the church, a number of bands reverted to playing the sash and clearly broke the restriction. Such triumphalism was also apparent in East Belfast, with incidents reported to the Public Prosecution Service. Women, however, marched alongside men, so this wasn't a totally male display. There was a discernible orange women's presence, for example, apparent, and again, you know, they have more of a tradition of parading. What's harder to decipher is any official involvement from the Ulster Women's Unionist Council in this event. Rather, this body celebrated a different centenary in a different way. So in 2012, they marked their foundation. And whether this was a deliberate distancing from the Orange dominance of Unionist commemoration is actually very hard to decipher. But in commemorating their establishment, they held a Thanksgiving service at St Patrick's Cathedral in Armagh. They had a reception and a dinner at Parliament Buildings in Belfast. And they referred to the organisation as, and I quote, providing an outlet for the political talents of hundreds of thousands of Unionist women, which continues to promote Unionism through the hard work and dedication of its members, but very hard to find them in this type of display. Covenant has long been used as a generic term to cover both the male document and the female declaration. So people talked more popularly just about Covenant commemorations, but that shorthand obscures women's role in the event. Often what we saw, and again you can look at the press and you know, think about how this was remembered, combined male and female signatories are often cited for the Covenant alone. So some sloppy historical shorthand going on there. And that obscures, I think, the dynamic and the scale of that women's declaration in Ulster. In 2012, the BBC News website also reprinted the text of the Covenant, but not that of the women's declaration. The Ulster Scots Community Network in the same year produced a pamphlet understanding the Ulster Covenant to mark the centenary and explain the event. But it too only produced the text of the Covenant and in 27 pages just made two references to the number of women who signed the declaration. So again, that display of Ulster Day, I think, totally obscured by a preoccupation and some sloppy labelling with the Covenant. The signing of the Women's Declaration was therefore a significant event for female unionists, but arguably not a seminal one. But the marginalisation of women in the unionist movement, which Ulster Day and its centenary commemoration in many ways typifies, has arguably continued both in the unionist and in the more popular memory. The unity of unionism, therefore, has arguably yet to be attained. Thank you very much.
Hi, Diane. Thanks so much. It was really refreshing to hear the Northern perspective on commemoration for change, and also to hear a unionist and, of course, a women's perspective. So I had a couple of questions, if that's all right. I was really interested in the fact that suffrage was not really seen as part of the equation, even though these women were becoming, you know, so politicized. And so I was wondering whether you could talk a bit more about that, and if you'd found records of any unionist women who were part of this council who were also involved in the suffrage movement. And second question would be just about this really dramatic shift from this domestic rhetoric to this militarization. And it just seems like this very stark kind of contrast. And so I just was wondering if you could kind of explain that a bit more for us.
Happy to do that. The suffrage positioning is really interesting. And I don't think this is unique. I'm sure a lot of you are, you know, maybe working on, you know, some nationalist organisations or have got some knowledge there. But this is political prioritisation. That's what the Third Home Rule crisis created. I think it becomes increasingly difficult to have any kind of shared political interest, because suffrage was seen as something which could slow down either the implementation of Home Rule or its resistance. So it becomes very, very hard to be in an organisation like this and be a suffragist. Now, there were some quite high-level pro-suffrage unionists. James Craig, the Union Second in Command, is one, was on local suffrage platforms until 1910, and then, interestingly, seems to fall off them. He's not there anymore. Again, this is this pressure, this is this process of prioritisation. So it affects men and women. The daughter-in-law of Theresa Londonderry, who becomes the seventh Marchioness, Edith Londonderry, very pro-suffrage, a member of Millicent Fawcett's National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies. Again, another mouthful of a title for an organisation. But and she produces a couple of suffrage pamphlets, again, interesting to read, dated 1911 and 1912, I think, from memory. But she is mostly active in England. I can't find her having any interaction. So that's her, that's the separation, that's how she manages this. So quite active as a suffragist, and actually later in life felt that the militant suffragettes had called it right and regretted that she hadn't been involved in that more militant wing of the suffrage movement. But in Ireland, this was all about Home Rule. So they won't talk about it. And again, I won't talk too much at length about this, but when unionists made their plans for provisional government, so taking things into their own hands to say, well, you can do what you want, we're going to organise ourselves, Carson makes this very peculiar statement to say that that would include votes for women. So the Irish Citizen has a field day, it's front page news there. Carson makes that comment once, he will never engage with it again. He leaves us no explanation. I've been through his terrible handwriting and all of his correspondence. There's nothing there. I think that might be a bit of a throwaway on his part, because he was avowedly anti-suffragist. He hated it, as did Theresa Londonderry. So this idea that this is going to be given as some kind of reward to unionist women for their activities, I don't really see that. They weren't asking for it anyway. And I think it's a miscalculation on his part. And then suffragists are claiming this as their victory, to say, well, look, if unionists have their provisional government, women will have votes in there. That'll be the first government, you know, in the UK that's going to have that. And then when he doesn't fulfil that promise and won't engage with it, we see the Pankhurst organisation, the Women's Social and Political Union, declaring war on unionists and moving into Belfast. And Belfast does become the hotspot for suffragette militancy by 1913-14 in the whole of the UK. And that's why, because they said, well, he'd said it and he wouldn't fulfil his promise, and therefore he was a traitor to the movement. And so they were targeting unionist property, and Carson in particular. So it's an interesting configuration, but say, I think it does fit into a broader context. Just briefly on second question on militarisation. Again, this doesn't seem to be much discussed. Probably the private correspondence of Carson and Craig, particularly with Theresa Londonderry, is maybe the best way into this. No one was delighted about this turn of events. People took it very heavy-hearted that they were going to perhaps have to take to arms, but they just see options diminishing. But very few people were pressing for it, and I think they thought they held back for as long as they could. And I do think there's a collective sigh of unionist relief in 1914 when the truce is declared, because really the spectre of that was fairly unattractive to everyone. People often ask me when I give a talk like this, do I think they would have gone to civil war? And I actually think they would, because I can't see any other way out. And they had either backed themselves into a corner, depending on your interpretation, or they'd been backed into a corner. And they're either going to have to say, OK, let's have home rule in September 1914, or do something about it. And, you know, the gun running and the preparations that were there, to me, all point that this wasn't just posturing. Some things in the campaign certainly are. But I think, yeah, I think they probably would have gone to it. But to say, reluctantly done. And that domestic rhetoric remains with this organisation. It doesn't go away. This just takes a different stand, really, or position at this point in history.
Thanks very much for that talk. It was really enlightening. And I found myself really moved by the story of unionist women. It was something I was not aware of at all.
You're not alone.
But I'm picking up also an undercurrent, an under-narrative of religious indoctrination and political isolation, which creates that kind of fortress-like under-siege mentality. And I was just wondering, is there any evidence? Well, we actually, Karen and I went to a workshop yesterday, and it was run by a guy who's directly descendant from Ulster plantationers, and recognises the whole significance of what that does in terms of dividing a country. I actually feel heartened by this, and I'm just wondering, is there any evidence within Ulster women's unionism that they can reflect on themselves? Because it's almost like their men have denied them permission to be themselves. Is there a revolution in that, in any sense, going on, do you know of?
Not that I could discern, but I want to put a proviso in there, in that I would look at them in their historical sense. Their records are fabulous up to about 1940. Really, really full. And then they tail off a little bit, sort of into the 1960s. And then material is closed, so it's hard to get a feel for them. In the more modern, I mean, you could do an oral history project. I just don't work that way. I haven't done that. So I can't really speak for them. You know, I don't think it's appropriate that I do. What I do think is it's really important not to lose sight of what they wanted to be, what they saw their position to be, because I do think it's very easy to victimise them. And you know, again, that's a hard line to draw. You know, what were you allowed to be? What did you need to be at this point? Because I think if this had been a really radical organisation in terms of engaging with votes for women, in terms of saying, yes, let's all drill, let's all take to arms, this would have been a much smaller force. And arguably, I just don't think the appeal would have been there. I think people needed reassured going into politics for the first time. That's why we have that very strong familial base to politics at this time. A lot of people are coming out of that family tradition, which you're, you know, really talking about in terms of a religious identity and a political one that's there. That's how people learn about politics. And there's a very strong link, we see it in the Orange Movement as well, family membership passes from generation to generation. So I think we see this in this organisation as well. But yeah, so really beyond 1967, I was interested to see how they were going to, you know, remember the establishment of this organisation. I was interested to look at them in 2012. But beyond that, I'm not sure. But I think they're quite open. I mean, I've certainly sent them some of my earlier work. They weren't aware of even the size of the body they had been. They were staggered. So even in terms of their own history with these, and they are amazing records, they weren't aware of it. I mean, I do detect this from sort of email correspondence and asking. They've been very supportive, you know, so I have to get permission to publish and everything. They've never tried to stop me doing any of that, which I think is really positive. I think they're happy that someone is at least working on them, and they're learning things about their organisation, because they are very under-researched. There was a very, very slim volume produced by Nancy Kingan, who was a member. It's like the official history of this organisation. It maybe runs to about 90 pages. I don't think it's much longer than that. That's all that was there. But there's much more, I think, that can be said, and you know, think about them in context and think about their significance. But always to me, it's to think about how did they view themselves, what were they trying to do, and not to maybe have the expectation that they were going to be radical and say, you know, we lead this organisation. Very rarely do we see that. Yeah, but it's interesting. That is all coming from a bigger cultural base, so I totally understand where you're coming from.
I'm going to take the chance next and then I'll get to you, because what you just said reminded me of Senya Pasetta's work on Irish nationalist women. She says they didn't expect to be forgotten. And how do we know that? Because they left loads and loads of records. Yeah. So they thought that they were doing something important. Mm-hmm. But my question, you mentioned that Cumann na mBan were watching them. Is there, could you say a little bit more about that? And also, was there any sense in which the unionist women were watching down south what the nationalist women were doing, particularly, you know, the Éireann na hÉireann strand or the more radical kind of women?
Actually, there's less comment on that, Jen, than I was expecting to find. Now, it could just be nature of the records that I'm dealing with, which are largely official for this. Mm. You pick up a more, maybe a more nuanced comment on, you know, the political other, looking at private correspondence. But even thinking about reactions to 1916, I've been asked repeatedly, oh, could you do something on unionist women's reaction to 1916? And I said, yeah, it'll be about four paragraphs long. There's very little. And it takes a while, and again, I think that's an interesting comment on that event and how that played out, for, again, people to realise the significance of that. What was that? So the confusion that we see in Dublin and elsewhere, certainly shared by these women, going, oh, I think someone calls it disgraceful at one point. But then, within about 6 weeks, pick up, and again, it's in correspondence rather than an official record, what might this mean? You know, and because they're still in the truce, they feel quite contained by that. That's when they start to worry and say, well, look, you know, there's going to be organisation on, as they put it, the other side. Can we afford to sit still? But actually, so that shows an awareness, I think, of the broader political climate and the changes that were happening. And some of these women were very politically astute. You know, in many ways, the positioning, I think, that they gave themselves in their early history was astute. You know, to tie it to domestic politics, to try and have an organisation. They wanted, as they put it, you know, the peeress and the peasant to be represented. This wanted to be an all-class popular body because that's what they thought this campaign needed. So there's a level of, you know, political savvy there which I don't think we should forget, although it does take this very specific place. And I think the influence of this domestic rhetoric, which McCarthy has commented on, because I was interested reading both organisations and thinking, God, that looks very familiar. You know, this talk, this politicisation of the home and protecting children and family, this notion of a woman's duty being there, but that didn't mean that you stayed in that place, that you could engage with the outside world, comes through very strongly in both of these organisations. But there's more comment, but again, it's not very extensive, on you know, the impact of this and how popular this had been in mobilising unionist women. And of course, you know, for a time, nationalist women thought they wanted to do exactly the same thing. They don't manage in such number. And again, I think that's that broader political climate. It's that sense of fear. Unionists felt that they couldn't sit back, and they're mobilising literally everyone they can, because they felt that clock from 1912 was ticking. And you know, the prospect of that, that's why this is such a sizable body. But it remained quite a large organisation even during the interwar period. And again, it tells us, I think, a lot about the Northern Ireland state and that insecurity that many unionists felt, particularly, you know, in the lead up to the Boundary Commission and things like that. They felt, well, if we relax and don't mobilise and don't make our voice heard, then the consequences from their perspective could be devastating. So there's not a huge amount, but what's there, I think, is really quite telling.
I just want to ask you a question, a reference really, about the crony offices in Belfast.
Uh-huh.
Are they more accessible now than they used to be, when they were up in Harlington Park?
Oh, yeah, no, they have moved to, you won't recognise it. Yeah, they're in the Titanic Quarter, it's all shiny and new, and it's great. Yeah. It's a really great place to work. If you haven't been, I'd really recommend it.
I put you off going to it before because you used to have to make an appointment to get into it again.
Yeah, no, it's not that. I mean, you'll still have to, you know, fill out, if you have it for the first time, you fill out a form and they'll take your photo when you get a card. But it's fantastic. It's a brilliant place to work, and they've got such a rich and an amazing collection. I mean, I could literally base myself there for several years and still be finding new material. And to say the records of this organisation are absolutely fantastic. You know, the Carson correspondence there. So if you're interested in unionism as well, there's a lot of things. And they've got a good website. Have a look there. and I wouldn't be deterred going down.
I've been on the website quite a few times.
Good, good. I think the online presence is much better than it used to be. It used to be you had to really do a manual search down there to find out what they had, but they've made great improvements in the last few years. So I hope you go.
Yeah, thank you.
Can I just follow on to what you mentioned about the declaration and being able to find individual people and their signatures mm-hmm. or their mark or whatever? In the records for the Ulster Women's Unionist Council, is there names of members in different branches?
Yeah.
So
the way that their records are arranged, so they have their ruling body, is their executive committee. So that's got all the great and the good. That's really Ulster's, you know, socio-political elite are on there. So you get lists of members of that executive committee, and then for every of their committee meetings, who has attended. So very detailed records. For the council meetings, and that's when local branches, those women's unions, association branches, scattered throughout Ulster would send representatives. So again, you'll pick up those, but there's also local minute books which have survived. So Dunmurry, for instance, I think I had a quote from Lurgan, so their separate minute books are there. So you're maybe not going to get an exhaustive list of members, but you certainly could if you knew or you were interested in a particular area, depending on where it is. But a lot of material has survived.
County Monaghan?
County Monaghan. I don't think that minute book is there.
Right.
I don't think. Double check. I'll happily double check when I get back to Liverpool and back to my notes.
Okay.
But there is reference to to Monaghan and those border counties. There's also some really interesting photographs, if you haven't seen them, of the UVF nurses.
The nucleus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Drilling at Castle Leslie.
Yeah.
That photograph.
Yeah, but there's a few more of those as well. So again, check that website, or don't hesitate to get in touch with me. I'm happy to help.
Oh, thank you. I was just wondering, you know, moving on from what you were saying in the answer to Colette's question about whether you've picked up that there was any sense of loss on the part of women on either side of the divide in response to what happened in the development of the Ulster Unionist Women's Council, because, and again, relating back to the workshop yesterday, Colette and I visited her mother, who was brought up in working class Belfast, mm-hmm. and, you know, and spoke about the bond between people, you know, in that class that share a common experience. Mm-hmm. And you would have thought that there might have been some sort of bond with the women, you know, on both sides. And I just wonder, is there any evidence of a loss of that as a result of what happened? Have you picked that up at all?
I haven't, but I think that's kind of the nature of this organisation and what it was aiming to do and what mattered to it. And it's, I think it's a comment on also how deep some of those divides sadly run. You know, and just we were talking, I was thinking, you know, thinking about, you know, the frustration that someone like Connolly or Larkin felt, you know, Belfast, thinking that big industrial base should have been the hotspot for working class collaboration. It's not there because people are asking the question, are you a Catholic or a Protestant trade unionist? So I think the positioning that we see is understandable. And again, from a unionist perspective, in many ways they did what they felt they needed to do. But I think, and this is especially apparent for someone like Isabella Todd, who I started with, a lot of these people don't really have a particular issue with Catholicism per se. They've got, there's a fear of the Church of Rome, you know, so, you know, Randolph Churchill is home rule is Rome rule. That's a really revealing comment. That's where the fear is. A lot of, you know, these people were operating in more liberal circles, you know, Todd certainly was, you know, with a big, strong Presbyterian liberal base. But that didn't mean that they didn't have any kind of affinity or collaboration with those of different either Protestant denominations or of the Catholic faith. As it develops, I think it becomes narrower and narrower. And I think that configuration, you know, that construction of the six counties rather than the nine feeds into that. That sense of insecurity that feeds an awful lot of this is there. So they rarely comment on kind of, you know, a broader coming together. And I think that's the nature of the movement, which has really shaped, you know, the more recent history of Northern Ireland. And it's a sad and a troubling history. in many ways. So I just don't see that from this movement.
We have exercised Diane enough, I think, now. And please, can you all help me thank her properly as we usually do?
Oh, thank you all. Thanks.